Nathan Fraser Show, episode 54, How to Capitalism, with our very special guest, Tom Woods of TomWoods.com.
Government is inefficient and should be dissolved.
What government should actually do is just leave people alone to buy and sell freely among themselves. If they just leave self-interested traders to compete with one another, markets are guided to positive outcomes as if by an invisible hand.
It's free markets that are moral because you only succeed if you meet the needs and wants of other people.
One of the hard things for people to understand is that the more you try to control an economy, the more quickly it falls apart.
Capitalism. God's way of determining who is smart and who is poor.
All right, we got a lot to cover this week. To start off, a classic interview from the archives.
I went from rapping about chemtrails and get more bay to rapping about how business owners can get more pay before these status fools.
We need tools to defeat them.
Free FM, focus on freedom.
Tom Woods from TomWoods.com. Tom, how you doing today?
Doing well, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
I have to say thank you for joining me today. I am incredibly honored, and when I reached out to you and you responded, I was just completely dumbfounded. I couldn't even believe that you got back a hold of me, so thank you for coming on. Now, you do the Tom Woods Show, and I would like to allow you at the beginning of the show to kind of let people know who aren't aware of what your work is. What is it that you do that makes you so busy that you rarely have the chance to come on a show like mine?
Well, I did recently just finish a huge project that has given me a little bit of extra time, thank goodness. I spent about 2 years, actually, creating courses for Ron Paul's homeschool curriculum, which you can visit at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And I created about 400 videos on history, from antiquity up to the present, and on government. But my government course is the exact opposite of every other government course you've ever heard of, because my government course is an anti-government course. It's a whole series of lessons on things the government shouldn't be doing, and here's why, and here's what Rothbard said. I mean, the kids are not going to know what hit them when they take these courses. So that took a lot of my time. But I do keep busy because for some reason, once I finish one thing, I tend to jump into something else. I've written a bunch of books. I've had some success with those. But now I have this daily podcast. I've also been doing that for about 2 years. I release a new episode every single weekday at TomWoods.com. I've had everybody from Ralph Nader to Ron Paul on the show. I've had Kane, the WWE wrestler. I've had just a wonderful variety of guests. And a lot of times people say, I love the episodes with guests I've never heard of because it makes me walk away saying the Liberty Bench is a lot deeper than I thought it was. It's all these people I'd never heard of. It's not just Ron Paul, Peter Schiff, Judge Napolitano. There are a whole bunch of other people out there, and I try to cover just every topic under the sun that might be of interest to libertarians or might be something that your friends are arguing with you on, you don't know how to answer. My tagline at the end of the show is become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day.
Yeah, and I have to credit you with this. Before I really started delving into economics and political structure, I've always been kind of an anarchist-minded individual. I was very liberal in my upbringing, so I was kind of like a government should not exist, but if it does, at least it should take care of the poor. And I started listening to your show, and between your show and reading Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, you two pretty much completely did a 180 on my understanding of economics and history and everything. And so I just wanted to thank you for that, because a lot of times people say you're just barking into the wind when you're trying to get these ideas out. But for me personally, the work that you have done and your recommendation to read that book was actually what made me do a turnaround on my understanding of economics. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk with you about today. I wanted to propose an imaginary scenario. We're constantly inundated in the liberty movement and in the conspiracy theory, quote-unquote, realm of this October or this September, the economy is going to collapse and the government's going to fall apart and all this fear-mongering. I kind of wanted to just kind of pretend that that actually did happen. And in the wake of that, we had a debate about property rights, because that seems to be the biggest qualm or the biggest difference between the anarcho-socialists and the anarcho-capitalists and the free market libertarians versus the left libertarians is this idea of property rights. Where do you fall on the idea of property rights? Are they a legitimate right, or are they a way for hierarchy to oppress people?
All right. Well, even within the private property rights, the people who favor private property rights realm, there's even a debate among those people as to whether the right to private property is a natural right that you have just by virtue of being human, or it's a conventional right that the community grants to you because it seems to work better on utilitarian grounds, but you don't strictly have a natural right to your property. Well, I do come down on the property rights side, and I do come down on the natural rights side of the property rights side, but I can also make a utilitarian consequentialist sort of argument. I can say that things do in fact work better if we have private property. And I realize that runs contrary to what people would think, because I think most people don't really sit down and reflect on things like this. So I think people would be inclined to go along with what Rousseau said, that, you know, private property in a way is a kind of theft, for that the first person who stood on a plot of ground and said, "This is mine," is the person who introduced conflict into the world. I think there are people who feel like that's probably right, but, you know, what are we going to do? This is the society we have. But to the contrary, I would say it's the person who says nobody can own anything who introduces conflict into the world. And the reason for that is every one of us has goals that we want to reach. And typically we can our imagination is limitless in terms of all the goals we could conceivably want to reach. And there aren't enough resources in the world for all of us simultaneously to carry out and try to pursue all the goals we could possibly pursue. There just isn't enough of everything. So we have to figure out some way that we can get along with each other in society without, if I may use this word, trespassing on the rights of other people and the pursuits that other people may want to follow. And how can we do that, given that there's a limited amount of stuff and there are more people who want to use that stuff than there is stuff? And the answer is we need some system that would clearly indicate that this property belongs to one person as opposed to another. And what that means is that this property can be used by this person. If we go around saying nobody has any property, well, if we understand property means something you can use according to your own discretion, then to say nobody has property means nobody can use anything unless presumably they get the consent of everybody else. Maybe we say that we actually own everything in common. Well, all right, if I'm growing an apple tree then, do I have to get the consent of everybody else in society to eat that apple? Well, obviously we'd all be dead if we had to do that. So to say that nobody owns anything, that can't possibly be right, because that would mean that or that we all own it together, that would mean I'd have to get the consent of every other person. That's not possible. So if your theory means the human race perishes, it can't be right. So there's that. But then secondly, suppose you and I both want to use, we both want this particular watermelon, and we both want the entire watermelon. Now, you could say, well, you could share the watermelon. All right, well, let's imagine that there are things that that you couldn't share. Let's say we both want to use a particular car at the same time, and I want to drive to A and you want to drive to B. Those are mutually exclusive goals. Well, how does it help to say, well, nobody really owns that car, or we both own the car? How does that help? How does that help decide who uses it right now? Well, it doesn't. And so you and I would have to come to blows over that. There would be no way to resolve that. So, I mean, you could say, well, okay, I'll let you use it, but then I'm giving up what I wanted to do with it. And so then, so in other words, what property rights do is they make clear in a way that everyone can understand, they draw a connection between an individual human being and an individual good or plot of land or whatever, so that we minimize conflict. Everybody understands this is the sphere in which I am allowed to act on this particular land, and you can't tell me what to do. And here is the sphere in which you are allowed to act, and I can't tell you what to do. And this way, instead of constantly screaming and arguing with each other, well, I want to grow corn in this land. Well, I want to build a building on this land. There is no resolution for that. But there is a resolution if we establish that I have satisfied the conditions that make this plot mine. And you have satisfied the conditions that make that plot yours. And so you can live your life peacefully. I can live my life peacefully. And we don't have to vainly scream at each other over what's to be done with any particular good or any particular plot of land. Everybody knows, everybody can establish for themselves, this person is the owner because he has satisfied these requirements that we can all perceive. And so private property rights come about through various ways. But we can tell ways that they couldn't possibly come about. We couldn't have a system of establishing property based on verbal declaration, that if I simply say, okay, that's mine, well, that doesn't – we want property because it helps us resolve conflicts, potential conflicts over scarce resources. But if I can claim something as my own simply by declaring it to be my own – you could just as easily declare it to be yours, and a third person could declare it to be his, and a fourth person. So we haven't resolved conflict at all. We've only magnified it. We need some system that if I abide by it, everybody can see that I have done that. And so what Hans Hoppe recommends, following sort of in the path of John Locke, Hans Hermann Hoppe, following in the tradition of John Locke but expanding on him, simply says that we have a first user, first homesteader principle. The first person to use something that's never been used before, or to homestead land that's never been homesteaded before, we recognize that person as the owner. And the reason is that if we were to say, and by the way, we see this just, you know, I had it first. We all know that instinctively as children. But the reason is if we were to say, well, how about the fifth user gets to be the one who decides what's done with it? Well, that would mean the first four users can't do anything. They can't even act with the thing. They can't grow food. They can't do anything until the fifth person comes along. There's no obvious alternative to this because, as I say, we have many goals we all want to reach. We have a limited amount of goods, so we can't reach all our goals. So we have to figure out some way to prevent conflict, given that there is conflict implicitly here, in that I have so many things in mind with what I want to do with all these things, but you have a lot of things in mind that you want to do with those things. We have to parcel this out somehow, and private property rights allows us to do that, to get along with each other, despite the fact that we all have goals that can't all be reached because there isn't enough stuff to go around. Only property gives us a peaceful resolution of this problem.
Now, I'm going to do something that I hear you do quite often on your show, and I'm going to play
devil's advocate.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, coming from my old point of view, and this is really easy for me to slip back into, what if I took the position that you owning this property is violating my right to travel? I want to get to point A, but in order to get there, I have to cross your property, or in order to get there as quickly and efficiently as possible, I have to cross your property. How is your owning property not a violation of my right to travel?
Okay, well, I guess I would have to get into your right to travel. Now, it sounds good. I mean, everybody feels like he has a right to travel, but simply asserting a right is not the same thing as demonstrating its existence. You do have a right to travel in places where you've been invited. But surely even you wouldn't say that my right to travel includes my right to travel into your bedroom, travel into your bathroom, to be taking a shower in your tub. So certainly you realize there at some level is a limit to the right to travel. Now, if you had a longstanding right to, you know, let's say there was some previously unowned property and everybody used to just walk through it. Well, oftentimes this establishes an easement right to use this property. So even if somebody builds a house next to it, then we recognize this longstanding right to pass through this part of the property. So there are ways to incorporate what you're asking for. But really, you yourself realize that I can't travel anywhere I want. I mean, really, I could be following you around all day, all around your house, and I would just be saying I'm asserting my right to travel. You'd say, hold on a minute. There's a limit to your right to travel. And I'd say, okay, what is the limit? And what it would really come back down to would be property. It's that you don't have a right to travel on my property because this is my sphere of action. You know, given that, I mean, suppose I had elephants and you've got your property and I just say, I want to stampede my elephants through this area. And if you were to stop me, that would be violating my and the elephant's right to travel. At some point, you would say, I don't want elephants crossing through in front of my house all the time. I don't want strangers coming through or getting drunk on my property or throwing bottles everywhere. I don't want that. But on what grounds can you assert that you don't want that if your view is that no one can make decisions on any particular property because there's no such thing as property? It leads to all kinds of undesirable situations, and it leads to conflict where otherwise we would at least have some kind of understanding that here's where I can go, there's where you can go, and now we don't have to fight with each other over it. And now you don't have to disturb my peace. Because if you just trample through my property, you may say you're asserting your right to travel. But you're also disturbing my right to privacy. And if we're just going to talk about these abstract rights disembodied without being rooted in property, we're not going to be able to resolve this. Because you would admit I do have a right to property to privacy, and you have a right to travel. How can we resolve those two rights other than by coming to blows? The only way to do it is through establishing property rights. And then we realize that I have privacy on my land and my property, and you have the right to travel on your property and on the property of anybody who will freely admit you. And then we have no struggles with each other anymore.
Okay, so I'm gonna start throwing some curveballs at you.
So that one wasn't one. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was a good explanation, but these are where it really starts to get tricky. So say me and you are neighbors, and you have to wake up early tomorrow to get to work on time, and I have the need on my property to entertain guests and play music loudly until 2 o'clock in the morning. Where does your, how do we resolve, absent government, absent you calling the cops on me and me and you getting into a big conflict about this is my property, well, this is my property, how do right. we resolve issues like that where I'm doing something on my property, but it is interfering with your ability to enjoy your property?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. Well, without having to get into the weeds of anarcho-capitalist theory, I'll just say as an assumption that in the absence of government, we would still have some institution that we would delegate, well, that I would hire for the purposes of security, for example, because we believe in the division of labor. There's no reason that, in the same way I don't do my own plumbing, I don't do my own making my own clothes, I also wouldn't do my own protection services. I'd have a gun maybe and a security system. But apart from that, I mean, I'm not going to monitor my property all the time. I have other things to do. So I would have an institution, and you would have an institution that you would go to if you were robbed or whatever, because we can't be vigilantes. I'm not good at it. I don't know where to look for the guy who stole my stuff. So I would hire somebody who specialized in it. So first of all, I'd have an institution that would help me in a case like this. So let's bear in mind there would still be some institution that would help resolve situations like this. But the question would be, how would it be resolved according to the principles of private property? How would that institution come to the right conclusion? And I see two possible ways out of this. One would be, I think people are much more likely in a stateless society to arrange themselves in what today we recognize as homeowners associations, that I'll join a neighborhood, but basically everybody understands that one of the rules, you know, one of the rules of this neighborhood that we all agree to when you pay your fee, and if you don't agree to it, then don't move into this neighborhood, is that after a certain time of night, the music has to stop. Now, it may be that I want to go to bed at 9, and the homeowners association says the music can go on till 11. Well, then I either have to change their minds on that, or I got to find a different house. So it may even be that, you know, even with some rule in place, it still runs the music too late for me, but that's the rule. Well, likewise, on your end, the rule would be, look, you agreed to this, you consented to these rules when you moved here, and so if you're in violation of these rules, you're going to have to ask you to leave. So private property helps to resolve it. But suppose we're not in a situation like that. Suppose we're just two isolated households. We don't belong to any association. How would we resolve it then? Well, this is very similar to the question that Murray Rothbard examines in his book, The Ethics of Liberty. He takes the example of an airport making a lot of noise. Obviously, you got airplanes taking off all the time. And that's not even a question of they're doing it late or early in the morning, which maybe they are. It's they're doing it all day long, and it's really annoying. So how would we resolve that? We've got all these houses near the airport, and the airport is creating this unconscionable level of noise. And his answer is, it depends again on who was there first, because there is no non-arbitrary way to resolve this. There's no way to say, well, this is a reasonable level of noise. There's no non-arbitrary way to resolve that. So instead, you deal with the idea of the easement. You say that if there's an airport here first, and it's been emitting a certain level of noise over the years, and then suddenly I can't just build my house next to the airport and immediately start complaining about the noise. Like, well, the airport has been there for years emitting this noise. I knew that when I moved in. So we would say that the airport has homesteaded an easement right of noise emission. But suppose that the houses were there first, and then the airport comes along. Well, the houses have grown accustomed to a certain level of quiet. So the airport would have to come to some kind of accommodation with them. Maybe they pay them. Maybe they say, this is the level of noise we're going to be emitting, and if you guys are okay with that, we'll pay you some amount to make you whole, given that you're going to be suffering an inconvenience. So in other words, there are ways through easement rights that these sorts of issues can be resolved. If you have not, as my neighbor, homesteaded an easement right to emit noise at all hours of the night, then I would be in the right. But so in other words, there are ways of dealing with who's been doing what the longest. And then, of course, there's also a question of, you know, presumably two neighbors can try to figure out some way to work things out with each other. Like I could say, all right, look, I'll just put up some white noise machines in my bedroom, but in exchange for that, maybe you could mow my lawn. I mean, we should also bear in mind that human beings are not always going to be looking for conflict. A lot of times they will be looking for reconciliation, and they're going to look for ways to resolve their differences, and there is a multitude of ways that we can do that.
Okay, so I've got, I have so many questions for you.
Where the heck did the time? My answers are too long-winded, I think.
No, they're great, because they really get to the heart of these matters. Do you mind if I ask you one more question, and then we can plug some of the stuff that I'm really excited that you're doing?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay, one more question, and this is probably the biggest conflict that I see arise. The argument between absentee ownership and abandonment. When somebody, say let's just pretend or assume that we both agree that you're the first person to use this property, so you have the right, and then you aren't using it, say like a summer home in Bali or something like that. While you're not using it, what differentiates an abandonment from an absentee ownership, and why is one legitimate and one... At what point, how long do you have to not be using something before I can step in and start using it?
All right. Well, let's say, I mean, obviously, if I were to drop dead, then, you know, that I'm really going to go a very long time not using it. So there would be some kind of common law, because, I mean, with something like that, there's no non-arbitrary answer. It's sort of like, you know, at what age do we let people start driving? Well, we know it's not going to be age 9. But we know it's not going to be age 35. So we have to, at some point, just pick a random number. So at some point, there is a random number involved here. I don't know what the number would be, but it would be something we would figure out together. But here'd be my comparison. Suppose I buy a suit, just a regular men's suit, and I hang it in my closet, and I wear it only once a year. If I wear it only once a year, does that mean that people can just come into my house and just use the suit? As long as they dry clean it, bring it back, and hang it up, can they use the suit if I'm only using it once a year? It's the same principle as an abandoned house, an abandoned suit. Or maybe I only use my computer once a week. Does that mean that other people can use my computer the other 6 days? Now, maybe there are some people who would go to that extreme. But then would they really want that principle turned around on them? They're not always in the shower. Couldn't I come use their shower? Now, they would say, oh, but, you know, look, I'm in the shower at least once a day. But it seems like the amount of time is, to some degree, somewhat arbitrary. I mean, everybody goes on vacation for a few days. Does that mean that if I go on vacation for 3 days, my property is secure? But if I go on vacation for the summer, I could come back and people are squatting there? Well, why? What's the difference? So in the same way, the people who are squatting, there are always going to be things that they themselves aren't using. I mean, you know, heck, when they're sleeping, maybe they're not even using their physical body. Think of all the bizarre things we could do there. I mean, so in other words, I don't think these people would really consistently apply this principle in their own lives, because we all, I mean, again, I don't use my car 24 hours a day. Does that mean I have to be content to have people driving it around, or I have to leave a schedule out, people sign up for times to use it? This would be highly impractical. And secondly, I actually gain a certain – I gain a psychic satisfaction from knowing that something is there even when I'm not using it. I might not be using my security system all the time, but I'm glad to know that it's there. I'm not using my car all the time, but I'm glad to know that it's there. I'm not using the however much money is in my savings account. I mean, that by definition, I'm saving it. I'm not using it all the time. But, well, this is a bad example because the banks do take that money and go use it while I'm not using it. Bad example. But surely the average person can't just come into my bank account and say, well, look, you're not going to miss it. You're not using it right now. It's some of the value I get from things comes from not using it, from just the security of knowing that it's available to me. And you are violating that interior disposition of satisfaction and content and comfort that I gain from the property, even when I'm not just, you know, using it in an obvious and more crude sense.
Awesome. You just hit every single ball that I threw at you out of the park today. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Where can people go to find more of your work?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I have two podcasts. I have a million things I'm doing, but they all pivot around one thing, which is my weekday podcast, TomWoods.com. So that's the first thing, TomWoods.com. But secondly, Bob Murphy and I have a podcast now every single week. Every single week, we refute Paul Krugman's New York Times column. And so what we're trying to do is teach economics by refuting Krugman. So the show is called Contra Krugman, and it's up there at ContraKrugman.com. So join us at TomWoods.com and ContraKrugman.com.
Free minds, free markets, free people.
All right, before we jump back into the show, I did want to take a moment and let you know about the new website, freemarketsquad.com. From there, you can find links to the online community, the online Facebook group, secret private Facebook group. Easiest way to get connected with it is by going to freemarketsquad.com. You can also find links to this here podcast. There's also a blog there with all kinds of insights about running a business and writing effective sales copy. And I'll be opening in the very near future. I'll be reopening the webinar registration for the Secrets of Building a Successful Business webinar. Last time we held it, it was a hit. I want to hold it again. I'm not sure. It's probably going to be within the next couple of weeks. I'll be opening up registration for that again. To be the first to be notified, make sure that you're checking Free Market Squad frequently. You can find the website again, freemarketsquad.com. All right, let's jump back into the show.
Let me ask you something. Haven't you ever been tempted to just break the rules and finally
get back at my big faceless corporate bosses for making me feel so small and insignificant?
Look at this, Marge. $58 and all of it profit. I'm the smartest businessman in the world.
Government can print money, but it's the entrepreneurs who really make the money.
Why don't you guys just make your cars cleaner and nicer and try to be better to your customers so that you can compete with Handycar's popularity in the marketplace?
Shut up and take my money.
All right, Free Market Squad in the place to be. Thank you for taking an hour out of your day to hang with me. And I hope you enjoyed that interview at the beginning of the show. I apologize for just jumping straight into it. It's actually an archive of Live Free FM. It was an interview that I did with Tom Woods, and I thought it was a great thought exercise, and I thought it was just a good conversation. Right now, the debate between left anarchists and right anarchists is kind of like at an all-time high, so I figured it's relevant to revisit that conversation, and I didn't want it disappearing into the memory hole of the internet. So that's why we had that at the beginning of the show, but that's not the only reason why, and I'm going to explain a little bit of what's been going on in Nathan Fraser land right now.
I'm not a guru, I'm not an activist, I'm just an entrepreneur and an anarchist, trying to be a leader and deal with haters, man. This is my life, welcome to Nathan Frazier Land.
Alright, so we did take a shortcut on the beginning of the show. Instead of coming up with all new original content, I revisited some stuff from a previous episode of Live Free FM, partially just because I'm a lazy bastard, partially because I have just been overwhelmed with work lately. So to let you catch up, or to bring you up to speed, Podcast Blast Off has been doing maybe not exceptionally well, but the last couple of months we've been bringing on a lot of new customers, and it's been a little bit overwhelming. I'm still trying to get the onboarding process into place. And I've also been working on a super top secret project with one of the world's greatest copywriting teachers out there. We've been working on a copywriter's podcast, and it's been taking up a lot of my time trying to get this set. And he's actually going to be hosting his podcast on Podcast Blast Off. So that's great news for the company. We're continuing to make more and more profit each month. We're bringing on bigger and bigger name podcasters. That is super fantastic. But at the same time, we're not at the point yet where we can, where we've got stuff systematized and where we've got the ability to bring on virtual assistants or anything like that yet. So I've just been getting my butt kicked with a lot of extra work, and I've taken on two copywriting jobs in the last couple of weeks that have also been taking it out of me. So I am probably guilty of burning the candle at both ends. And this here podcast, Nathan Frazier Show, has probably suffered a little bit because of it. And I do apologize for that. That is why I kind of cut the original content in half this week. It's good on one end. I'm making a significant amount of extra money. I'm getting my name tied to some very big movers and shakers inside of the copywriting and advertising world. Podcast Blast Off is doing amazing. But it did take its toll on Nathan Frazier Land, which, if you know me, this is kind of like my therapy. It's my venting, it's my place to go and rant besides my emails. And so I kind of feel like I've neglected it. I've neglected you, the listener. And so I apologize for that. At least it's not under bad circumstances, though. It's the curse of success, I guess. All right, so enough of that. Enough of bragging about how awesome my career is going. Let's go ahead and jump into this week's Free Market Squad section of the show, the Church of the Invisible Hand. I'm not sure what I call this segment, the BYO Boss segment, but whatever it's called, let's just jump right into it right now.
For my Free Market Squad members out on the grind, you gotta be your own boss, can't just fall into line. You gotta have a free mind and hope for the future. You gotta be the free market anarchopreneur.
Alright, Free Market Squad, in the place to be. So we're gonna just jump into some basic entrepreneurial skills that you need in order to pay the bills as an entrepreneur. And I'm just going to go through, I don't even think this is a numbered list, so I don't even know how many there are. These are just some of the skills that I have found. Maybe I've had to develop them in myself. Maybe they're skills that I just innately had. But these are some of the most important, valuable skills that I can attribute any of my success as an entrepreneur to. And I kind of wanted to maybe do a deep dive on each one. Maybe not a deep, maybe a shallow dive. I don't know. I'm a shallow guy. So maybe we'll just do shallow dives. But I just kind of wanted to touch a couple of different skills that I believe are vital, necessary, very important to have in order to be successful in any kind of entrepreneurial role. So we're just going to jump into it. And the first one, like I said, not in any particular order. I don't even know how many of them are here, but we're just going to go through them one by one. And the first one is, you really have to learn how to sell, and you have to love selling. So this is something that a lot of people get hung up on. A lot of people have a fear of selling. A lot of people have like negative feelings associated with selling. They don't want to come off as salesy. Somehow being a salesman is like slimy and sleazy. And I get it, but it's that one mindset will kill any kind of dream that you have. And the reason why is because sales is the fuel for your business. If you don't have sales coming in, you don't have money coming in. If you don't have money coming in, you don't have what it takes to run a business. You can't pay people. You can't pay to have your website up. You can't pay to get tools to make your service or your product better. Sales is the fuel of your business. And if you've got some kind of like negative hang up about going to the gas station and putting gas in your car, you're not going to be driving for very long. So if you've got some sort of negative hang up about selling, you're not going to go very far in the business world. That's just the way it is. And the thing to remember, this is one of the things that really helped me get over my personal negative feelings about selling, is that if you have something of value, if you have something that can better the lives of other people, you have an obligation to sell it to them. Some people might say you have an obligation to give it away, but it's like that old analogy. If you're on an airplane and the airplane starts going down and the oxygen masks drop, if you don't put your gas mask or your oxygen mask on first and ensure your own survival, you're not going to be able to help anybody else. So you need to take care of yourself first before you start taking care of somebody else. So if you've got a business, you need to take care of your business first before you start going out and doing charity work. Now, obviously, if your business is more successful, you'll be able to do more charitable type work, but you have an obligation to fuel your business, especially if it provides some sort of value to people. You have an obligation to get out there and make sales. And the last thing to remember is, no matter what you are, if you're a dentist, if you're a chiropractor, if you're a plumber, if you're somebody that hosts podcasts, if you're somebody that, no matter what you do, first and foremost, before being a dentist or a chiropractor or a plumber or a website developer, first and foremost, you are in sales. You are a marketer. You are a salesperson. Because without that skill, the other skill doesn't matter. So number one skill to being able to pay the bills as an entrepreneur is you have to learn how to sell, and you have to learn to love selling. Next one is, it pays off in dividends to be able to keep your calm in a storm. Entrepreneurship is hectic. It's crazy. There's ups and downs. It's like a roller coaster emotionally, financially. Some months you're going to be on top of the world. Some months you're going to be scrambling to pay rent. It's hectic, and it requires that you have a team that have faith in you. It requires that your customers have faith in you, and whoever your clients, whoever it is that you're serving, they have to have faith in you. And if you lose your shit every time stuff goes crazy, every time something goes sideways, you start freaking out and pulling your hair out, your teammates, your employees, your customers, they're not going to have faith in you. They're going to realize that you don't have faith in yourself. You're not able to keep calm in the middle of the storm. And if you don't have faith in yourself, you don't have faith in what you're doing, why should they have faith in you? So you really need to learn how to temper your emotions, how to control your emotions rather than let your emotions control you. You have to be able to keep calm in a storm. And there's a quote from one of my favorite books. I try to go back and read this book every single year. It's called As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. In my opinion, probably one of the best books on mindset ever written. And there's a quote in it. The quote says, "The strong, calm man is always loved and revered. He is like a shade-giving tree in a thirsty land or a sheltering rock in a storm." And to be an entrepreneur, to be a leader, to be somebody that teammates and coworkers and employees and customers look up to, you need to be that sheltering rock in the storm. All right. The next one is to seek to add value. This is like something that I think capitalists get misconceived. They get a negative view that they don't actually deserve is that people always accuse capitalists of being greedy and that all we care about is getting paid and all we care about is money. The truth is, the most successful capitalists, their number one goal has to be to add value to the marketplace, because success is about, it's not about taking, like most leftist media and leftist college professors would have you believe. Success in a free market is about giving. It's about providing. It's about adding value. Any kind of trade in a free market, both players have to come away from the trade feeling like they got more than what they went into with. That's how free market economics works. That's what makes it. That's what makes a trade work, is that both people feel like the other person added more value than they ended up having to sacrifice. So if in the free market, if you don't provide something that the marketplace finds valuable, they won't reward you. You will go out of business. The days of the snake oil salesman, the days of the sleazy salesman, that the con artist salesman, those days are long gone. It's almost impossible to get away with that stuff now. There's things like Yelp, there's internet reviews. If you try and scam people nowadays, you're not gonna be able to go from town to town doing it. You're gonna have people out you. Even if you find like a get rich quick scheme where you find some sort of like fluke where you can scam people out of money on the internet, you'll be outed and people will catch on to it. If you find some sort of like black hat tactic in Google algorithms or Facebook algorithms, they'll catch on to it and they'll cut you off. They'll stop it. So even if you find some sort of get rich quick scheme that works today, they'll cover it up. They'll make a patch for it and it won't work tomorrow. So it's short money. So to have long-term value in a free market, your number one goal needs to be seeking to add value to the marketplace, seeking to add value to the lives of your customers. The next one is you need to learn how to play to your strengths and delegate everything else. So as entrepreneurs, as leaders, one thing that I've noticed in myself and that I've noticed in other people that are kind of in the same mindset is we have a tendency to try and take everything on by ourselves. We have a tendency to try and carry the world on our own shoulders. And we see things where we have flaws. We see things where we have weak points and we're like, I really need to sharpen that skill. I'm not very good at doing so-and-so. So I need to dedicate the next year of my life to really learn, deep diving in, to learn how to do that well. And that's really not the approach to take. At least I'm learning that's not the approach to take. What I'm finding to be more effective is to play to my own strengths and hand off the things that I'm not so good at to people who do enjoy doing those things, to people that do those things better than I do. If I can't, like I'm not, when it comes to computer programming, I'm decent at doing CSS. I'm decent at doing HTML. I'm okay at coding PHP, but when it comes to things like SQL, MySQL, when it comes to things like JavaScript, I am not good at all. So I have people on my team that I hand that stuff off to. I'm not going to waste my time focusing on those things when I could be investing my time focusing on things that I actually bring the most value to. And that way, I'm working on the things that I enjoy. I'm working on the things that I do the best. I've got other people working on the things that they do best. And that way, everybody's spending their time doing the things that they're best at. That way, your whole team as a whole has everything that needs to be getting done by the people that are best at doing it. And that way your whole teamwork as a whole is incredibly leveraged. So don't try and take everything on by yourself. Don't try and waste your time improving the things that are your weaknesses. Just find out what you're not so good at. Hand those things off to other people. That way you have that time to focus on the stuff that you actually are good at doing. Next is this something that I find everybody, almost everybody has backwards. And that's the when they should be patient versus when they should be impatient. Everybody's so patient at the beginning of a project and so impatient at the end of a project. Everybody sits around and thinks and plots and schemes and dreams about how great this project's going to be. And they'll spend years just contemplating how awesome this new business idea is going to be. And so they're super patient at the beginning of the process. And then when they actually start breaking ground and they start trying to bring this dream to life, if they don't get those immediate results, they give up on the project before they can even hit their stride. So they've got all this patience at the beginning of the project. And then once the project actually starts, they just lose all of their patience. And then they become very impatient at the end of the project. And what I found to be a much better way to approach things is to not have patience at the beginning, to not sit around dreaming, to not sit around pondering, to not sit around scheming, but to be impatient at the beginning of a project, to just dive in and start working on it and get it going, even if that means just get the outline plotted out, even that, if that just means start working on the graphics or start working on how it's going to be monetized or what funnels I'm going to be putting into place. Be very impatient at the beginning of a project. And then on the second part of a project, after you've got the ground broke and you're starting to actually make some headway, then you need to be patient, because any kind of project, any kind of business, as you're trying to get it started, it's going to be the first couple of miles are going to be very, very tedious. They're going to be very hard to get through, and they're going to require a lot of patience. Podcast Blastoff, for the first year, we weren't profitable. We were putting work and we were putting money into Podcast Blastoff every single month and not seeing any kind of payoff. Around the 1 year mark, we started getting more customers that, you know, we were starting to bring in more profit than it was taking to keep the business afloat. And now we're getting more and more customers. And if this trend continues, by the two year mark, we should be a very profitable company. But if we would have given up in that first year because we were super impatient to get started, but then we were also super impatient once we were going, if we would have given up in that first year, we wouldn't have hit the point where we're at now, where we actually are turning a profit each month and we're actually getting more and more customers coming on each month. So don't be patient at the beginning and then impatient once you get going. Be very impatient to get going, and then once you've gotten started, then you need to be able to exercise patience and not give up before you actually hit that point where things start compiling. Next is kind of related to this, which is don't wait for all of the lights to be green before you start your engine. I see so many people that they got to plot out the perfect business plan, and they got to figure out the perfect name for their business, and then they got to come up with the perfect sales funnel and the perfect sales copy, and they have to have everything in line before they're willing to pull the trigger. And I don't agree with that. I agree with understanding where you want to go, having a general direction on where you want to be aimed at. But if you build out an entire sales funnel, and when you go to launch it, you realize that the very first landing page, the headline is just not converting well at all, then all of the previous steps after that don't even matter. Because same thing if you put all this time and money into a project where you haven't even tested to make sure it's something that somebody wants to actually buy. A lot of times people will put all of this work into something and want everything to be perfect before they're willing to introduce it to the market. But the fact of the matter is, you're not going to be able to create the perfect product until you've actually tested it on the market. You need to introduce what they call a minimum viable product. You need to release something to the market and then get feedback from people, and then go back and take that feedback and then implement it into what you're doing. Instead of trying to build the perfect product without any feedback and wanting everything to be perfect before you even introduce it to the marketplace, that's the equivalent of waiting until all of the lights are green before you start your car. I say kind of have a good direction on where you want to go, start the engine and start driving. If you have to take a detour because the market says, hey, we did like this, but we didn't like this, you need to make a right-hand turn, then make that right-hand turn and then get back on course. But don't wait until every single light is green before you start your engine. And this one, this next one is kind of maybe a little bit contradictory, but I'm going to try and explain it the best way that I can so that it makes sense. And that is the idea of sometimes, especially in marketing, especially in trying to sell yourself as a consultant or sell your product at the very beginning, especially of any kind of entrepreneurial venture, sometimes you have to put the cart before the horse. Now, I've heard people say, oh, you just got to fake it till you make it. And I'm not a big fan of that. I don't like the idea of faking it till you make it. I think it's dishonest. I think it's insincere. And so just that whole idea of presenting yourself as more successful than you actually are. And I realize everybody does this to an extent. You see it on Facebook. I myself am probably guilty. And you know what? I'm not even going to say probably. I know for a fact I've been guilty of selectively choosing what I post on Facebook so that people don't see some of the things that I'm struggling with, but do see some of the things that I'm proud of. That's just what we as human beings do. But as far as like deliberately misleading people, as far as like faking it till you make it, I'm not a big fan of that. I don't like that. I think it's dishonest. I do my best not to allow people to think, a fake it till you make it version of me is the real me. But I am a huge proponent of putting the cart before the horse, which means I will go outside of my comfort zone. I will take on jobs that I'm not 100% that sure that I'll be able to do. But I'll say, yeah, I can do that for you. And I'll say yes, and then I'll figure it out as I go. Like I said, sometimes you have to say, okay, we're going here. And all of the lights aren't green yet, but we're going to jump in the car. We're going to start the engine. And I'm not sure if we're going to have a clear path. I'm not sure if there's going to be detours, but this is where we're going. Sometimes you do have to put the cart before the horse. Sometimes you do have to say, yes, I can do that. And then you have to figure it out as you go. If you never go outside of your comfort zone, if you never say yes to something that you're not sure that you can actually accomplish, you'll never be able to realize your true potential. You'll never be able to realize what it is that you actually can accomplish. If you only stick to things that you know you're comfortable with, that you know that you can do, and you never, you know, travel outside of your comfort zone, you'll never be able to make any significant accomplishments in life. And I'll say the caveat to this is, only say yes if it's a hell yes. When you go from scarcity mindset to opportunity mindset, you start seeing opportunities everywhere, and you'll probably say yes to a lot more than you should. You'll probably bite off more than you should chew. So once you get it out of opportunity mindset and kind of into investment mindset, you start being a lot more picky about what you say yes to. You start to overcome that fear of missing out, FOMO syndrome, and you start to say, okay, there's four opportunities. This one's going to be the most challenging, but it doesn't have the most reward. This one is also kind of challenging, but this one definitely will have a better reward. This is the one I'm going to say yes to, and the other ones I'm going to have to say no to. And that's, like I said, that's something that we all have to come to in our own way. And then the last one is just being able to accept payment. I know that when I first started taking on jobs, I was very hesitant to take payment. I would always underquote what my services, what I felt they were worth, or what other people felt that they were worth. Maybe I should do a whole show on accepting payment and figuring out what you should price your services or your products at. But don't be shy about asking to get paid. Don't be shy about when somebody asks you how much you charge. Don't be shy about letting them know what you charge, and be confident. Don't lose your confidence. Don't lose your poker face when somebody asks you what you charge, because if you do, they're going to realize, oh, he's not confident in what he's charging. Maybe I shouldn't be confident in what he's charging or what he can deliver. or she, if you're a female listening. Don't undervalue yourself. Don't lose your confidence, and don't be shy about getting paid. So those are some of the most valuable skills that I've found when it comes to being a successful business owner. I hope that they help you. In fact, if you actually go back and listen to them and get the message, I know that they will help you. They've helped me. So until next time, Free Market Squad, faith in each other, not in authority. I'm out of here. Deuces.
Free minds, free markets, free people.
And before we're out of here, one final plug for a project that I work on, Podcast Blast Off. We've got all kinds of stuff on how to improve your podcast, how to grow your audience, how to launch your podcast, how to dominate iTunes, everything you need to know about starting and hosting and growing your podcast is available for you over at podcastblastoff.com. Make sure you check that out if you are interested, even in just the slightest bit, in starting your own podcast. That is a wealth of knowledge. Number one resource for starting your podcast online. Check out podcastblastoff.com. All right, I'm out of here, Freak. I fucked it all up. I'm out of here, Free Market Squad. Deuces.